Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 2013 Henry and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellowship Lecture. My name is Fred Logevall, and I am the director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies here at Cornell. I'm also a faculty member in the History Department, and I have the distinct pleasure to welcome this year's Bartels World Affairs Fellow, Kishore Mahbubani, about whom we'll hear more in a moment, and also to welcome all of you to what I think is going to be a most stimulating lecture, followed by Q&A and a reception. Since its founding in 1961, the Einaudi Center, which just celebrated its 50th anniversary, has helped to stimulate and support and to catalyze Cornell's work in and about the world. And in addition to the specialized programs that it houses and supports, the center provides a broad forum for dialogue that reaches across the disciplines. And it serves and has served, I think, with considerable success to internationalize the university's teaching, research, and outreach agenda. And the Bartels World Affairs Fellowship is a very key component of this broader endeavor. And the fellowship helps to fulfill what I see as director as perhaps our most important task of all at the center, which is to foster a broader understanding of international affairs, especially among our students at Cornell, graduate and undergraduate, but really the whole university community. And it is therefore, I think, a key part of the fellowship that in addition to giving a public lecture, the fellow also should interact with faculty, with students, both undergraduate and graduate students, in more informal sessions in class. Today's guest is no exception. We've really been working him hard during the day today, and he's been a really good sport about it. And it is thanks to the vision of Mr. and Mrs. Bartels that a great many distinguished visitors have been here since 1984 as Bartels Fellows. I think your program lists this group. They include, for example, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. They include His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. They include former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Louise Arbour, journalist and foreign policy expert Fareed Zakaria, and most recently, former president of Chile and director of UN Women, Michelle Bachelet. Hank and Nancy Bartels could not join us this evening, and I want to say on behalf of Cornell University and everybody at the Einaudi Center that we are grateful to the Bartels family for establishing this fellowship back in 1984, for providing our community with these stimulating and much discussed talks by prominent international figures. I also want to take this opportunity to thank the Bartels family for our new postdoctoral fellowship program at the Einaudi Center. This is a new program in the areas of foreign policy, security studies, and diplomatic history. And we will begin this fall with two fellows in place at Einaudi, each of whom will teach an undergraduate course in addition to doing their research. I also would encourage you finally to check out our website at the Einaudi Center for upcoming events, speakers. We have several on tap this spring, the next one being Charles Kupchan, professor at Georgetown and a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who will speak a week from tomorrow, that is February 21st at 4:30 p.m. in Lewis Auditorium on the end of Pax Americana, a subject that I think suggests a certain connection to our speaker today. Today, we are honored to welcome to our campus a distinguished diplomat, academic, and writer, Professor Kishore Mahbubani. He will be introduced by Cornell's provost, Kent Fox. And I want to say that the provost's steadfast support of the Einaudi Center during these past years, during a difficult economic environment, has been, I think, immensely important to the center, more broadly to international studies at Cornell. I ask you now to join me in welcoming Provost Fox.
Thank you, Fred. I join in Professor Logavall's welcome to all of you that are here in the audience. You're in for a treat with our lecture today. As Fred said, the Bartels World Affairs Fellowship Lecture is an event to which the entire Cornell community looks forward. And we're grateful not only to the Bartels, but also to the Anoudi Center itself for its sponsorship of this talk, of this fellowship, and also, obviously, we give our thanks to the generosity of Hank and Nancy Bartels for the many distinguished lectures that they have sponsored and that have graced Cornell. Today, it's my honor, as Fred said, to introduce the 2013 Henry E. and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellow, Professor Kishore Mahbubani. Few today know Asia as well as Kishore Mahbubani, and even fewer combine it with a deep understanding of the West's strengths and frailties. Those words come from a colleague at the University of Chicago, Professor Rajan, commenting on Professor Mahbubani's latest book, The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World, which was published just last week, and its title is also the title of today's talk. How Professor Mahbubani came to know both East and West so well is a story that began in Asia in rather modest circumstances. He was born in the British colony at that time of Singapore to Indian parents, but was fortunate enough to have a strong, determined mother, and also not far away a free library, where he devoured books at every opportunity. His love of reading eventually led to his admission to the University of Singapore, where in 1971 he earned a degree in philosophy. He wanted to be a philosopher, but his scholarship obligated him to work for the government for 5 years. So he began a career in Singapore's Foreign Service, although along the way he did find time to earn an advanced degree in philosophy in 1976. Professor Mahbubani remained in the Foreign Service for some 33 years and was posted to Cambodia, to Malaysia, Washington, and New York. He served twice as Singapore's ambassador to the United Nations in 2001, and May 2002, he served as president of the UN Security Council. He returned to academia in 2004, and today he is the dean and professor of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. Throughout his career, Professor Mahbubani has made a name for himself, both as a skilled diplomat and also as a thoughtful and compelling and provoking writer. He has been honored by the government of Singapore with his Public Administration Medal, and also he's received the Foreign Policy Association Medal. He has been hailed as one of the world's top 100 intellectuals by Foreign Policy and Prospect magazines, as one of Foreign Policy's top global thinkers in 2010 and 2011. His widely noted books include Can Asians Think? Understanding the Divide Between East and West, published first in 1998, Beyond the Age of Innocence, Rebuilding Trust Between America and the World, 2005, and the New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East in 2008. As a reviewer noted, speaking of the New Asian Hemisphere, quote, he takes the rules established by the West on democracy, rule of law, and social justice, holds them up like a big mirror, and he shows the distorted reflection practiced by US and Europe. As Professor Mahbubani himself has said, quote, the main goal of my writings is to awaken the world to the completely different historical era we are entering. We are fortunate to have him today as our speaker and to discuss, quote, the great convergence, Asia, the West, and the logic of one world. Please join me in welcoming Professor Kishore Mahbubani.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that very generous introduction. But as you know, after you get such a generous introduction, it all goes downhill. Let me begin first of all by thanking Mr. and Mrs. Bartels for this wonderful fellowship that they've endowed at Cornell. I'm really honored to be here. I hope you convey my thanks to them. And I've really been happy to come back here because some of you may not know this, I'm a very old friend of Cornell. I first came here in 1975 because at that time, I don't know, the I'm sure you all know this, Cornell was regarded as the global center for Southeast Asian studies. Many of my friends were studying here. Many got their PhDs here. So this was a sort of the dream place to come to for many Southeast Asians. So I'm glad to be back here now after almost 40 years, back again in Cornell. Now, the difficulty, as you know, when you give a lecture is deciding how you start. You know, in America, you begin with a joke. In Asia, you begin with an apology. So sometimes the best thing to do is to combine the two traditions and sort of apologize for the bad joke. But the bad joke actually was told originally by the first chief minister of Singapore, Mr. David Marshall. And he was of Iraqi Jewish origin, which is interesting because Singapore is a predominantly Chinese society. And one of his favorite stories was about a young Catholic priest who was very devout and wanted to pray all the time. But then he also had this habit of smoking, so he couldn't take the tension within smoking and praying. So he finally went to see his bishop and he said, you know, Monsignor, may I have your permission to smoke while I'm praying? So the bishop replied, said, out of the question, impossible, no smoking will be allowed. So he walks out looking dejected and then meets another priest in the corridor and explains what happened. And the older, wiser priest says to him, come with me, there's been a misunderstanding. So they go back to see the bishop again and then he says, Monsignor, there's been a major understanding. All that our friend here wants to ask is permission to pray while he smokes. And the bishop says, of course, how can anyone deny a man permission to pray? Now, I begin with that story because it's such a good way of telling that you can have the same event, right, described in two exactly opposite ways. So there can be two narratives about the same event. So in the same way, I believe that in the world of today, there are two dominant narratives about our world. The one, of course, the stronger one, the one that has actually dominated the global discourse for the past few hundred years, of course, is the Western narrative. And then now what you find emerging, in a sense, is a non-Western narrative to balance the Western narrative. And the paradox about our time is that for a long time, the West always provided the most optimistic societies of the world. The believers that you could make the world a better place and they would succeed in making the world a better place. But today, in a remarkable reversal of a very long historical pattern, we have a situation where the West has become progressively more pessimistic. I mean, if you want to drown in pessimism, just go to Europe, you know? And you'll find very few young people there believe their future will be great. If you go to Spain, I forget what the unemployment rate is for young people, it's about 40% now. So that kind of, that obviously creates a dramatic sense of pessimism. So by contrast now, it is the rest of the world that is becoming more optimistic. And so this is, in a sense, is the main reason why I wrote this book, The Great Convergence, and what I'm going to speak about today, because quite remarkably, that while the 12% of the world which lives in the West are progressively, as you know, becoming more and more worried about the future, the 88% who live outside the West are actually becoming more and more optimistic about the world and about the future. And this is therefore by far the most optimistic book that I've written of all the earlier books that I have done. Now, so what I propose to do in an effort to explain what is the thesis of the book, I'll do it in three parts. First part, I'll try to share with you some good news. I may actually drown you in good news. so that to make you understand why there's so much optimism now in the rest of the world. And then, of course, I mean, as you all know, the world is not a perfect place. There are challenges we face. I'll discuss some of the big challenges the world faces. And then I hope to end with giving a few remarkably simple prescriptions that we can follow to make the world a better place. And there are some incredibly easy, I think what's called in American discourse, low-hanging fruit out there that we can pick to make the world a better place. And it's a pity that it's not being picked, and that's why also why I wrote this book at this time. So let me begin with the good news. And, you know, if you want to understand the good news, the best way to put it is that the world has never been better than it is today in several dimensions. And so let me give you two or three concrete examples. Firstly, as you know, since the dawn of history, the number one thing that most societies have been concerned about are issues of war and peace. And throughout history, wars have killed millions and millions of people, destroyed societies, and we've always thought that there was an eternal feature of the human condition. But today, and it's amazing that it's going unnoticed, wars are becoming a sunset industry all over the world. The danger of a major interstate war is the lowest it has ever been. In fact, in very few places do you fear that war is going to break out in a big fashion. And so as a result of that, the number of people who are dying in conflict, again, is the lowest it's ever been since statistics have been kept. In my book, I quote two major sources. The first is a Harvard professor, Steven Pinker, who wrote a book recently called The Better Angels of Our Nature, and he provides some remarkable data. And what is significant about Steven Pinker's data, by the way, He doesn't just say that less people are dying as a result of less conflicts. He's also saying there's less violence in human society today. And that is a remarkable shift and improvement in the human condition. So maybe as recently as the 1950s, 500,000 people would die in some kind of conflict or another. Today, barely 30,000 die in any kind of conflict in a year. And even though the population, as you know, has grown dramatically since the 1950s. So that's one very sharp drop that has happened. And if you travel through region after region, you can see that, with the exception, of course, of the Middle East and places like that, by and large, people in many regions are experiencing greater peace. And of course, the best place, incidentally, to describe where peace has come is Southeast Asia. You know, when I grew up, Southeast Asia was supposed to be the Balkans of Asia, and we experienced all kinds of conflicts, communist parties, internal insurgencies, war in Indochina, and now Southeast Asia is at peace. And maybe someday, I hope, you should encourage a young PhD student in Cornell to write a thesis, did Cornell University bring peace to Southeast Asia? And he may have, you know, and I'll explain later why it may have. So that's one example how lives have improved. The second example, you know, we've always been worried about global poverty, about people at the bottom, you know, people who are starving and so on and so forth. And here too, something remarkable is happening. You know, in the year 2000, when I was ambassador to the UN, the UN established something called the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. And they set up several MDGs about education, you know, health and everything. But one of the most important MDGs that they established was that we should strive for the halving of global poverty by 2015. 2015, by the way, is 2 years from now. And You know, the amazing thing is that while many of the MDGs will not be met because they were fairly ambitious goals, the halving of global poverty will be met and in fact will be exceeded. We have actually done a remarkable job in reducing global poverty. And of course, a lot of it, of course, you can guess is due to the success of China and India. I mean, China alone has lifted 600 million people out of absolute poverty as a result of its rapid growth. So we have done something remarkable there. And by the way, when you do that, the benefits percolate very widely, you know. Just about two Sundays ago, when I arrived in New York, I happened to be turning on the television set, watching Farid Zakaria's show, who was a Bartels World Fellow last year. And he was interviewing Bill Gates. And so he said, we asked Bill Gates, how do you see the future? And Bill Gates said, oh, I'm very optimistic. So Farid says, why? Why are you optimistic? He says, very simple. He says, in his work, and you know, he's trying his work, his best to help people who are very poor and suffering. He said, I think if I remember the statistic correctly, he said, Farid, as recently as 20 years ago, 20 million babies would die below the age of five. 10 years ago, it went down to 12 million. Now it's down to 5 million. Now, why is this statistic important? This statistic is important because babies, as you know, are the most vulnerable citizens of any society. So when babies die, the ecosystem that is supposed to protect them is not working. But when babies begin to survive, it shows that the ecosystem has been created to protect these babies, whether it's hygiene, education, healthcare, whatever it is, it's improving. And so less babies are dying. And so that shows how we are, in a sense, reducing global poverty. And most remarkably, one of the most traditionally most conservative institutions, institutions in the intelligence agencies, and an organization like the National Intelligence Council, you can predict will be very conservative about talking about the future. But the National Intelligence Council has confidently predicted that global poverty will be eliminated totally by 2030. To make such a prediction, you obviously got some positive trends you got to build on to achieve that. Now that's at the bottom end. Now at the middle class end, something even more remarkable is happening in the world. Now, as you mentioned, Kent, you know, I grew up in Singapore in relatively poor circumstances. In fact, I was put in a special feeding program when I was 6 years old because I was technically underweight. Now you can see that's no longer the case. I lived in a typical third world Singapore. There were ethnic riots. Our per capita income was the same as Ghana's, $500 a year. So I grew up in a traditional, and we had no flush toilet. I mean, I grew up in a traditional third world environment. But now Singapore is, you know, in one lifetime, gone from being having the per capita income of Ghana to now having a per capita income that is even higher than its former colonial master, the British. So we have superseded the British in terms of our per capita income. So, and everyone thought that the Singapore story, oh, is just a small exception. But that Singapore story is now being replicated on a massive scale. And I won't give you too many statistics, but if you want to leave with one statistic that, in a sense, drives home the point that we are experiencing what's called the Great Convergence, just remember this one statistic. Now, today in Asia, out of the total population, about 500 million people in Asia enjoy middle-class living standards, right? Not a small sum, 500 million. But by 2020, now that's, by the way, only 7 years from now, that number is going to explode from 500 million to 1.75 billion. An increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. The world has never, ever seen this before. This is the most remarkable transformation in human history, a remarkable upliftment of the human condition, and this is all part of the great convergence that is happening. And globally too, by the way, there are now several, there are World Bank sources, there are other sources that you can find that will show that globally the middle classes are going to explode all around the world, and by 2030, more than half the world's population will be enjoying middle class standards. That's a new world coming from the Great Convergence. Of course, the big question to try and figure out is, why is this happening? And I honestly confess that there are so many factors at play that drive the Great Convergence that it's hard to say which are the ones that are the most critical. But one point that I emphasize in my book and in my writings and everywhere is that the reason for this Great Convergence is that overall, in all parts of the world, people are coming to a common understanding of what it takes to build a good society. You know, there's a common set of aspirations developing all over the world. And that's why also wars are diminishing. Because most countries now realize that it's the stupidest thing you can do is to go to war. Now, this you may think, oh, that's pretty normal. But remember that barely 100 years ago, right, when Norman Angell wrote his famous book, you know, saying the world has become so interdependent, war is not a possibility. Instead, as you know, the World War I broke out. And some people say to me, Kishore, what you're saying in 2013 reflects what people were saying 100 years ago when they said there'll be no wars. Instead, World War I broke out. But the difference between our time, 2013, and 1913, is that in 1913, the zeitgeist was such that it was glorious to go to war. And so the brightest young minds from Oxford and Cambridge would sign up and say, give me a gun, I want to go and fight a marital war for little England out there in the continent, right? So everyone thought that's the honorable thing to do, go fight. Today, you have to be remarkably stupid to do that. And I say, I travel around the world, I meet very few young people saying, give me a gun, I want to go fight in Europe or fight anywhere, right? So that's an illustration of Steven Pinker's point that violence is becoming less common in human society. And by the way, his explanation for why things are improving in the world, which I agree with and which I reinforce in my book, is that there's been an escalator of reason around the world, and we are all, most of humanity is going up the escalator of reason. We understand what it takes to build a better society for our people, and we are doing so. So a common set of norms are enveloping the world, and that also is part of the Great Convergence. So I actually believe that in the years to come, the world will become better and better, and we should recognize it and take advantage of it and strengthen it. And that's why, again, I wrote the book. But let me now quickly turn to assure you that I haven't got my head in the clouds, that I understand what's going on in the world. And so as someone who's been in diplomacy for 33 years, I'm perfectly acutely aware of all the challenges and problems there in the world. So let me discuss some of the key challenges and problems that the world faces now. Let me just mention just three, okay? I mean, there are many, but let me just mention three. The most important challenge, especially in geopolitical terms, is always the one between the world's greatest power and the world's greatest emerging power. The world's greatest power is the United States of America. The world's greatest emerging power is China. And as you know, throughout history, with one major exception, And the one major exception was when the British ceded the number one spot to the Americans. That happened quite peacefully. Maybe the British thought, let's hand over power to another Anglo-Saxon country. Makes no difference anyway. But today, when the Anglo-Saxons have to hand over power to, for the first time in several hundred years, to a non-Western power, in theory, we should be seeing rising levels of tension between United States and China. And if that happened, that would be perfectly normal. It is normal to see rising level of tension between the world's greatest power and the world's greatest emerging power. Which is why it is quite puzzling that you're seeing the opposite. If you look objectively at the US-China relationship, and there are tensions, there are difficulties, there are rivalries, but overall the level of tension has been going down between the two. And of course, you can say this may be accidental, but I suspect it also reflects conscious decisions that have been made by various policymakers. I think on the Chinese side, they have worked out very carefully a rather sophisticated long-term policy of how to emerge as a great power, which I discussed in my previous book, The New Asian Hemisphere. And they have decided that the best way to stabilize the US-China relationship is to create a very deep interdependence within the two. So as you know, China relies on the United States to provide markets for its manufactured products. That's why China has a major trade surplus with the United States of America. But at the same time, it creates a balanced dependence, and the United States relies on China to buy US Treasury bills so that they both need each other at this time. And this is and the reason why this is unusual, if you go, just think back, many of you, I'm sure, can still remember the Cold War, and remember how there was virtually no trade between the United States and Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union certainly didn't buy any U.S. Treasury bills. See the difference between that time and this time about the deep interconnectedness that has happened. And this deep interconnectedness, which I think is going to grow in the years to come, will also mean that the tensions between US and China will be managed and not get out of hand in the world of tomorrow. We can discuss more, of course, in a Q&A if you have any questions in that area. Another big challenge, and the one actually I worry about to some extent a bit more, is the one within the what I call the tension between Islam and the West. And this, as you know, has got very deep roots. It goes back to the Crusades 1,000 years ago. It hasn't been fully resolved. And that's why also, as you know, it's not a big secret that many of the conflicts you see today happening are either in or around the Islamic world. You see that happening in Syria today. You see it, to some extent, turbulence in Egypt and Tunisia and so on and so forth. There are some tensions and difficulties in that area. But I also believe, by the way, that if you look at it objectively at the Islamic world as a whole, you'll be surprised to discover that the majority of them are actually enjoying the great convergence that I speak about. And to give you one simple example, a country that Cornell knows very well, Indonesia, right? You know, Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. It has a population of about 240, 250 million, larger than North Africa combined. I mean, if you add up Egypt, Algeria, Tunisia, Indonesia's population is bigger. So while everyone is focused on the difficulties in North Africa, they forget that the world's most populous country, Muslim country, is steadily growing at 6-7% a year, comfortably. And now is on its way to having one of the top 10 largest economies in the world in the next 10, 15 years, and no one's noticed it. And a country like Bangladesh, which Henry Kissinger dismissed as a basket case, right? He said, this country will never succeed. It's been growing at 6% over the last 10 years. So there are parts of the world in the Islamic world that are also experiencing the great convergence. And I think that's going to spread. But there are obviously certain sections of it, especially in the Middle East and North Africa, that are having problems. And here, one point I'm going to make, a very delicate point, and I've got to make it very delicately here, which is that if you really want to remove the poison, and it is a fact that there's some poison in the relations between West and the Islam, there is actually a small silver bullet solution that's available, which is to have, as quickly as possible, a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. Believe me, if you can do that, that will make a huge difference in terms of changing the chemistry of the relations between Islam and the West. And I actually wrote a column in the Financial Times, I think about a year ago, and I said, speaking as a friend of Israel, I said to Israel, please, now is the time for you to make peace with Palestine and have a two-state solution, because time is no more on Israel's side. Because if you look at it over the next 10, 20 years, even though the U.S. absolute power will remain the same, the U.S. relative power will decline, and the power of the Islamic world, I guarantee you, will rise in the next few decades. So Israel will be squeezed by declining U.S. power and rising Islamic power. So time is no more on Israel's side. And I say, as a friend of Israel, make peace now. Don't wait until things go badly for you. But that's another example. Thank you. I'm glad one person agrees in this room. I say that because it is a very delicate and sensitive subject to raise in most places, and that's why I have to raise it very delicately. Now, let me also mention the third other challenge, which actually is not a geopolitical challenge, but which I think is the number one thing that worries many of you: what's going to happen to the global environment? We are all talking about the middle class. It's wonderful that the middle class is exploding. It'll hit more than half the world's population. They'll be going out there. They'll be buying refrigerators, cars, consuming more energy. What's going to happen to our planet? And that obviously is a challenge, and that's something that we need to address. And clearly, if we're going to find a solution to global warming, and I discussed that in the book too, we have to find a formula that allocates what I call sacrifice equitably across the world. Because there's no solution to global warming unless we all make some kind of sacrifice or another. And I can give you a concrete example why that's so important. As you know, both China and India have been put under a lot of pressure to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and therefore reduce their coal-fired plants and all that. But when someone told the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, who was a remarkably good man, by the way, what are you going to do about this? He said, Manmohan Singh replied, I think that's a fair response. He says, I am not going to deny 400 million Indians of electricity just so that Americans can keep on driving their SUVs, right? If you want Indians to sacrifice and maybe consume less electricity, when are you Americans going to sacrifice and drive less SUVs? So this is where the global warming thing comes about, that we have to find an equitable formula to settle this problem. And I actually, at the end of the day, am reasonably optimistic that we can achieve that kind of agreement. Why? Now, this brings me to the third part of my presentation on how we can continue to make the world a better place. And let me talk about the low-hanging fruit that is out there. The easiest, as you know, we live in one way or another, increasingly in a global village, right? It's becoming smaller and smaller. Now, every village, as you know, needs a village council. So if we are becoming a global village, we should be strengthening the global village councils rather than weakening them, right? And here, one of the things I do in the book is that I give away what I call a dirty little secret. And what is that dirty little secret? It is that it's been the consistent policy of the Western countries led by the United States of America to keep global village councils weak. And that's why the UN is kept weak, that's why the UN specialized agencies are kept weak, and that's why they're not functioning. Now, this may have made eminent sense when the West was completely dominant and assumed to be dominant forever. Say, we'll be number one, we don't need global village councils, right? But today, in a world that is changing so fast, when the West is increasingly becoming a smaller and smaller minority in the world, it is time for the West to rethink what its policy should be. And this is why I also begin in this book, in the very first introduction, with a quote from a speech that Bill Clinton gave in Yale in 2003. And this is what Bill Clinton said. He said, if America assumes that it'll be number one forever, then fine. We can carry on doing whatever we are doing. It doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. But he added, if we can conceive of the possibility that we may no longer be number one, but maybe number two, surely it is in America's interest to strengthen a rules-based order that will then constrain whoever is the next number one. Now, this is a remarkably wise thing for Bill Clinton to say in 2003. The tragedy is that he could not say it when he was president. Indeed, I describe in the book how his Deputy Secretary of State then, Strope Talbott, a friend of mine who came out with the book also, describes how when Bill Clinton was president, he actually wanted to raise the subject, isn't it in America's interest to build stronger multilateral institutions while we are number one, so that when we become number two, the next number one will be constrained by multilateralism. But Strope Talbott said in his book, all of Bill Clinton's advisors told him that if you raise this, it'll be political suicide for you. Americans don't want to hear about Americans being number two. And this is a real tragedy. Because frankly, now is the time for United States and the other Western countries to realize that it is in their long-term, rational self-interest to strengthen multilateral institutions. So I'm not appealing to idealism. I'm not appealing to altruism. I'm appealing to pure, naked self-interest. And it is in the naked self-interest of the West to change its policy towards multilateral institutions. And the thing that's actually puzzling me, and I haven't solved this puzzle yet, is how is it that the West, which always prided itself on having the most rational, the most sort of scientific, logical approaches to solving problems, is now doing the exact opposite when it comes to its long-term self-interest, which is that it is carrying on autopilot, continuing to weaken these multilateral institutions, even though it's no longer in Western interests to do so. So one of my biggest hopes with this book is to actually persuade the sophisticated Western audiences, especially audiences like this, to please go back and look carefully at your policies and change them now. Because, you know, if you try to create a new global architecture from scratch, It is impossible. But if you can take the existing global architecture and strengthen it, then you can do wonders with it. And there are some remarkably irrational Western policies towards multilateral institutions. To give you one example, it's been a Western policy. One way they keep multilateral institutions is to have what's called a zero budget growth policy. So even though the world economy has become bigger and bigger, even though multilateral institutions are large, handling problems of a larger global population, their budgets are actually shrinking. And that's because of Western demands. And this, as a result, is weakening institutions that the West should not be weakening today. And let me give you two dramatic examples. The first and the most obvious example, when you live in a global village, as you know, that if a pandemic breaks out, right, it's not going to stop at any border, right? Pandemics don't carry passports. They travel across borders effortlessly. So if you live in a small global village, it's in your interest to strengthen the global health agency, which is called the World Health Organization. And you know what? 20 years ago, 75% of WHO's budget came from regular assessed contributions, which the organization could rely on and therefore make long-term plans. And only 25% came from voluntary contributions, which could vary year by year. But if you want to develop a long-term network of health inspectors, you have to rely on assessed contributions and not voluntary contributions. After 20 years have passed, after we've experienced challenges like SARS, today, 25% of the WHO budget comes from assessed contributions and 75% comes from voluntary contributions. And that's insanity on a global scale. You don't develop a strong World Health Organization if you're going to make it rely on short-term voluntary contributions. You're weakening the global agency just when we need it. Another example, the United States and other Western countries are afraid of nuclear proliferation. If you're afraid of nuclear proliferation, what you need to have is more nuclear inspectors. To have more nuclear inspectors, you must give more money to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. And I thought, surely the West, which is so frightened of nuclear proliferation, would be giving more money to IAEA. Guess what? Again, the exact opposite. I discovered this at first hand because a few years ago, Ernesto Zedillo, the former president of Mexico, was invited to chair a commission of eminent persons to look at the future of IAEA. I was a member of that commission, and it was absolutely shocking to see how even the IAEA is being strangled by this irrational Western policies of depriving them of more regular assessed contributions. So these are examples of low-hanging fruit. These policies can be changed overnight, instantly, and they'll cost very little money. You know, if you want to understand how small the budget for the UN Secretariat is, the budget for the UN Secretariat, which takes care of 7 billion people, is smaller than that of the New York City Fire Department. If you can have enough money to fund the New York City Fire Department for one city of 7 billion people, surely you can fund something more for 7 billion people. Right? That's an example of how absurd the scale is. Now, of course, there are other multilateral institutions that will be harder to fix. There are organizations like the UN Security Council, the IMF, the World Bank. But in the book, I also provide specific, concrete ways in which they can be resolved. The UN Security Council has been trying to reform itself for 20 years. It set up an open-ended working group on UN Security Council reform. After 20 years, it's achieved nothing. So people say, why don't we just change the name of the working group from the open-ended working group on Security Council reform to the never-ending working group on Security Council reform. That would be a more accurate description. But you know, the reason why Security Council reform hasn't happened is for every new great power that wants to come in, for every Germany, for every Brazil that wants to come in, there's an Argentina that says, why not me? For every Japan that wants to come in, there's a South Korea that says, why not me? You know, for every Nigeria that wants to come in, there's a South Africa that says, why not me? And the best example, of course, when I was ambassador to the UN, came from Italy, because and when I was ambassador to the UN, Germany and Japan were pushing very hard to get into as permanent members of the UN Security Council. And the Italian ambassador stood up in a forum as big as this and said, you know, why are you only pushing for Germany and Japan to become permanent members of the UN Security Council? We, Italy, we lost World War II also, so we qualify. So you can see how deep, you can see how strongly these countries feel about this. So to solve that problem, what I have is a formula called the 777 formula, where you have 7 permanent members, but you also have 7 semi-permanent members taken from 28 states. So all these losers, you know, like South Korea and Pakistan and all that, they become winners because they get a semi-permanent seat when the neighbor gets a permanent seat. And so it's a way of breaking the logjam, which is what I've tried to do. So the reason I mentioned this is that everybody seems to think that when you look at the world and you see all these global problems and you assume there are no solutions out there, all I'm saying to you is that in many ways, there are solutions out there. And what's even more remarkable is that despite the fact we don't have a great global plan to make the world a better place, we are actually making it a better place. We should recognize it, and I'm confident that if we recognize it and take advantage of these trends, we can create an even better world in the years to come. Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Mabani and I are going to sit here and take some questions from the audience. There are going to be microphones up here, and I would ask those that want to ask questions to queue up at the microphones. So I'll start as the microphones are being set. Kishore, you were both president of the UN Security Council, and now you're an academic dean. Which jobs are harder?
That's a very tough question.
There are deans and others in the room.
Well, I can tell you what Henry Kissinger said. He said that academic politics is so much more vicious because the stakes are so low. Okay. And I don't know, but I must be fair, though. I'm very fortunate as a dean to have a very collegial faculty in the Lee Kuan Yew School where I'm dean. And most people tell me that's very unusual, by the way. But I'm very happy that we have that. And so I've actually enjoyed my 8 years as dean. But I should emphasize that when you're president of the UN Security Council, your hands are tied in many, many ways. Because even though in theory you're the president of the council, the power in the council rests in the 5 permanent members who have the veto. And the 10 of us who are non-permanent members really have very limited scope to make changes. So I would say I have greater scope to do things as dean than as president of UN Security Council.
Okay, fair enough. Any questions from the audience? Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with Darren Acemoglu and Robinson's thesis of history presented in Why Nations Fail. Basically, they're arguing that inclusive political institutions lead to inclusive economic institutions, and that's been the cause of the rapid growth that we've had. Mm. There are exceptions that temporary, in their view, of which Singapore is one, but as not having the democracy that they would define. But more interesting is China. And the projection of the future of China, the very rapid growth that they've had so far. What is your response, or what would you maybe want to reword their thesis and then project the future of China and a number of the other countries of the world that are now rapidly growing, like Vietnam? Yeah. that do not have inclusive political institutions, even though they seem to be growing rapidly and have a pretty competitive state capitalist system of economic production.
Yeah, well, I must confess to you that I haven't read the book, Why Nations Fail, although I'm aware of the thesis, and I think you did a very good job of summarizing it, by the way, that it, in their view, the countries that will succeed will be, I mean, they don't use the word Western. They use the word, as you said, inclusive political institutions, and therefore they assume that the West will continue to succeed. And what you've seen in China and Vietnam and elsewhere are just temporary phenomenon, and the West will win in the long run. And I mean, of course, you can never tell, okay? I mean, it may be true, this may well be true, it may happen. But I would say it's a, literally, from my point of view, is an exercise in great delusion. And the reason why I say it's an exercise in great delusion is that the great paradox here is that, you know, in terms of what's happening in the world, is that the Western project has succeeded, you know. As you know, the Western project was to spread science and technology, education, learning all over the world. And the West has essentially succeeded in educating the world. And the reason why a country like China is doing well is not because of its authoritarian system. Because, you know, it had an authoritarian system under Mao, it failed. It had an authoritarian system under Deng, and it succeeded. So what was the difference? And the difference was that, and this is what I explained in my previous book, The New Asian Hemisphere, countries like China and other Asian countries finally understood, absorbed, and implemented seven pillars of Western wisdom. And the seven pillars of Western wisdom, on which I normally give a one-hour lecture, but I'll just read them out to you. Free market economics, mastery of science and technology, meritocracy, culture, pragmatism, culture, peace, rule of law, and education. These seven pillars of Western wisdom are now actually being applied more powerfully in China than anywhere else. And so China's growth is not due to its authoritarian rulers, it's due to its ability to absorb and implement these seven pillars of Western wisdom. And more importantly, the Chinese mind has been opened up in a remarkable way as a result of 30 years of opening up and integrating with the rest of the world. So even, I don't know how long China's authoritarian government will last. I don't think the Chinese Communist Party can last forever. I think the Chinese Communist Party eventually at some point in time will have to give up power too. But that's not the critical variable. The critical variable is that the Chinese society is implementing all these seven pillars of Western wisdom. And the most provocative thing that I say, by the way, is that the paradox is that in some ways the West is walking away from its seven pillars of Western wisdom at a time when the East is embracing them. And to give you a simple example, for a long time, the United States was the greatest defender of free trade in the world, would always push for free trade agreements, push for the success of trading round after trading round. Today, the United States is, as you know, has great difficulty signing free trade agreements. And by contrast, the largest free trade agreements in the world are being signed in East Asia, between China and ASEAN, 1.8 billion people, within India and ASEAN, 1.7 billion people, within Japan and ASEAN, within South Korea and ASEAN, between Australia and New Zealand and ASEAN. And believe me, the trade is growing so rapidly in East Asia, and that's, it's one of the most amazing global phenomena we've seen in recent times, explosion of trade. And all these forces will carry on regardless of whether or not there is a Communist Party or not in China. So I actually, at the end of the day, believe that their thesis is wrong and that time will show that it's other factors, not the ones that mentioned, that will explain the success of societies.
Then you do not predict that the transition to democracy that occurred in Korea and Japan, of course, under our occupation, that appears to be have occurred in Taiwan as well, that's going to happen in Singapore and in China?
Well, by the way, I should let you know, and this is it's already happened in Singapore, by the way. In the last elections in 2011, three government ministers lost their seats. And I think these three government ministers, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Second Minister of Finance, and the Senior Minister of State Foreign Affairs would be very puzzled to learn that there's no democracy in Singapore after having lost their seats in elections. And just a few weeks ago, the Singapore government had a by-election in which it lost again. So, you see, this is an example of how things are changing so fast, and we have difficulty in keeping up with the new changes that are happening. And in the case of China, I keep emphasizing that China eventually will have to become a democracy. The destination is not in doubt. It's only the route and timing. And here, the Chinese learned a very powerful lesson from how the Soviet Union went from communism to democracy overnight. The Russian economy imploded, infant mortality rates went up, life expectancy came down, the Russian people suffered. So the Chinese said, we don't want the Chinese people to suffer in the way the Soviet Union did, in the way it transformed itself overnight. So the Chinese will be careful about having the Communist Party give up its rule. But even though China doesn't have the kind of political freedoms that the United States and other societies enjoy, there has been an explosion of personal freedoms in China. 30 years ago in China, you could not choose whom to marry. You could not choose when to have a child. You could not choose what to wear. You could not choose where to study. You could not choose your travel. That was 30 years ago. Today, the Chinese can do all those things. And each year, this is a remarkable statistic, 70 million Chinese leave China freely and go overseas. And each year, 70 million Chinese go back to China freely. Are they going back to jail? Are they so stupid? Are they going back to a despotic government? Or are they going back to a China that has experienced a far greater improvement in the last 30 years than it has in the past 200 years? So from the point of view of the Chinese people, they have seen the most dramatic improvement in their living standards, and therefore they have actually a very powerful reason for carrying on with the present system as long as it keeps working and delivering this rapid growth, because they have experienced far greater improvement than any of their ancestors ever did.
So, I think we have some questions over here. Please come to the microphone. Yep.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to thank you for coming to speak. My question is, what role do you feel multilateralism serves and could potentially serve in confronting global inequality? And more specifically, in terms
Sorry,
of...
Sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you repeat that, please?
Sure. What role do you feel multilateralism serves and could potentially serve in confronting global inequality in terms of wage earning profiles between workers?
Global inequality, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I hope... it's not so much multilateralism per se that's going to reduce global inequality. It is the whole... a global economic ecosystem that we have developed since the end of World War II that is part of the reason why we're having so, you know, in terms of global economic growth, we have experienced remarkable economic growth over the last, since the end of World War II, global trade has exploded. And as a result of countries integrating themselves with the global economy, that's why they are succeeding. So look at China, for example. China was a close economic system for 30 years, nothing changed, the Chinese people did not improve themselves. But when China opened itself up and integrated with the global community, then the Chinese succeeded in reducing poverty and also in that process, reducing global inequality. Now there are still, by the way, I must emphasize, there's still lots of challenges out there, okay? There are still lots of people who are still poor, who need help and so on and so forth. But the overall trend line is such that it is very positive. And that's why we need to preserve this global economic ecosystem that we have developed. Because if the West becomes frightened, and if the West becomes protectionist at this point in history, that will be a huge disaster. So our main priority, I think, in the next few decades is to keep this open system alive as long as possible.
So I turn to my right. Question over here.
First, Professor Mahbubani, thank you so much for speaking to us. I guess my question is on your contention that international organizations' budgets are very low And you know, the Western powers do have a role in perpetuating that problem. On that, I definitely agree with you. But I am wondering, however, if you could address, you know, the rising Eastern powers' corresponding lack of commitment as well. You know, for example, I believe, you know, People's Republic of China's contribution to the UN's main budget, depending on your source, is between, you know, low 3, high 3%. So I was wondering if, you know, how would you reconcile that fact?
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree with you. I do think that, I think, you know, the thing about China is that it adopted a very wise policy when it was rising, not to aspire towards global leadership. And that's why China took a very low profile internationally. But my message to the Chinese government is that you can no longer take this low profile. Now that you emerge as the world's second largest economy, you have to take on greater global responsibility. And so I agree with you that the Chinese government should pay more to multilateral organizations like United Nations and all. And I think it's in Chinese national interest to do that also. Unfortunately, the name of the game in United Nations is that, in theory, if these multilateral institutions are working to serve global interests, we should have a global consensus to raise contributions to the multilateral organization. But the name of the game in the United Nations, and I've been ambassador there for 10 and a half years, is a zero-sum game, right? Everybody wants to pay less. So, for example, since everything adds to 100%, so the United States reduced its contribution from 25% to 22%, as you know, some years ago. As a result, 3% had to be allocated to others. So everybody else fought off efforts to pay more, and that's a tragedy. But all that happened because the global community doesn't yet realize the value of these multilateral institutions, like the World Health Organization and so on and so forth. And once we can rebuild a new global consensus that says our world needs stronger global village councils, then I think we won't see this problem of countries shortchanging these multilateral organizations. Because I keep emphasizing to you, the amount of money that it takes to keep the UN going is peanuts. You know, I don't know how much the United States spent in the Iraq war. Was it $3 trillion?
Or, a lot, yes.
I mean, Joseph Stiglitz says it's $3 trillion. I mean, look at the amount of money you spend, $3 trillion over 7 years, right? Now, I think if you took, my maths is not that good, 1%, what is 1% of $3 trillion? Tell me. 10% is $300 billion, am I correct? 1% is $30 billion. Yes. $30 billion, you can fix the UN. No problem. 1% of what you spend in Iraq.
And have some left over for Cornell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Question here?
Yes.
Hi, sir. Whoa, sorry. I'm also from Singapore, and I just wanted to let you know that you're a true inspiration to me because you represent everything that someone from a tiny island can achieve. And that's just amazing to me. But my question actually is, I agree with you that there are very optimistic solutions to all the problems you've highlighted, but how optimistic are you that you're actually going to be listened to on the political level of decision making? Because it appears to me that while you're appearing to very naked self-interest, as you said, there seems to be a trend going on that a lot of people don't want to be rational about this.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I always believe that the best thing you can do is to try and write a book that's ahead of its time, right? If there was already a global consensus that, hey, the West should change course and support the United Nations and other multilateral, then my book is not needed. So, but I actually believe, but I have found over time, incidentally, the great thing about writing books is that they are there as a permanent record. You know, you can't take them away, they're there. And I kept saying, I started writing in 1993, my first essay for the magazine Foreign Affairs. I said, watch out, Asia is rising. 20 years ago. And with each passing year, each passing decade, every prediction I made has come true. You know? So whatever I say in this book, I'm confident will be rejected in the next 5 years, maybe 10 years. But after that, I'm confident within 10 years, people will see, yes, this is the right thing. So it's always good to write things ahead of time and then let time vindicate your message and not try to just parley the conventional wisdom of the day.
Any question on this side? Nope. Over here.
Hi. So my question has to do building off the two questions.
This is another Singaporean, by the way.
Yeah. Two questions that that came before me focused a lot on the idea of interest itself. And from the way I see it, you are suggesting the relocation of interest from the interest in transaction in the moment of transaction to a long-term sort of interest. So that's what your concept of sacrifice is trying to do. And so relating that to the manner in which economies are structured from liberalism to Keynesian-style economics to neoliberalism, are you then suggesting that there is going to be a real significant change in the way capitalism is being organized?
Well, I actually, you know, there was luckily for me, as I was flying here yesterday from Phoenix, Arizona, and amazingly, as our plane was taking off from Phoenix to Philadelphia, the pilot announced it's colder in Phoenix than in Philadelphia, which apparently had never happened before. But anyway, on that flight, I read the New York Times, and there was a column by David Brooks. And David Brooks, as you know, is a relatively conservative columnist in America. And he was saying, in the old days, the Americans used to, save for the future, right? So whatever they did, they invested in America. And capitalist system, by the way, and I think America was equally capitalist 50 years, 100 years ago. It was always investing in the future. This is how America built its great infrastructure. This is how America invested in education and so on and so forth. He says the difference in America today is that you still have capitalism, but instead of saving for the future, America is now borrowing from the future. Now, this is not a capitalist thing. This is a political decision that has been made by the current electorate in America to try and have the, to go, to support politicians who then give you huge budget deficits, which then in turn impose a burden on future generations. That's not capitalism, that's politics. And I actually think, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say this, that something has gone seriously wrong in the American political system. And is actually terrifying the world, by the way. We don't understand how you can hold the world hostage with this brinksmanship about, you know, your budget deficit and the fiscal deficits and all that. And then the whole global economy has to go on a sort of standby mode, waiting to find out what's happening in America, you know. Basically, the world is being held hostage by divisions in America. And I have a wonderful cartoon from The Economist, which shows the Tea Party leading the Republican Party by the nose, the Republican Party leading America by the nose, and America leading the world by the nose, and all four of them heading over to a cliff. And that's an example of how politics can go wrong. So it is not, I wouldn't say it's a capitalist system. I would say something has gone wrong in the politics.
So what I'm going to do is allow those of you that may have other questions to ask those in the reception. We have a reception being sponsored by Anaudi just outside the doors. But before we go there, I have a presentation to make. So let me go get my certificate and my gift. So on behalf of Cornell and in honor of Professor Mahbubani's presentation and lecture, we present the certificate and let me read it. It says, Cornell University names Kishore Mahbubani, Dean and Professor, National University of Singapore, former Singapore Ambassador to the UN and President of the UN Security Council, as this year's Henry E. and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellow. February 13th, 2013, signed by Professor Fred Logavall and our President David J. Scorton, who's out of town today. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Let's take a picture for us. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.